Listening to Phoenix 98 FM, and you've just heard Weathering the Storm from The Sleeping Souls. And I'm joined by Tarrant and Ben from The Sleeping Souls. Hello, gentlemen. Thank you for your time.
Hello.
How are you doing? Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolute pleasure. Sleeping Souls, you're probably best known for your work with Frank Turner. What's led to you stepping out on your own?
I think it's something that we've been thinking about for many years, basically. And then having Frank tours a lot, so we're out on the road a lot. And then we too have our own ideas of musical ideas that we would like to do something with.
Okay, and hence that's come about. And I'll touch on that a little bit later. We've just heard, as I said, Weathering the Storm. What can you tell us about that? That's the latest single from the soon to be released album.
Yeah, so that song is the main theme of that is really to do with what's been going on in Cahir's family life for the last couple of years. And it's really the idea is about just going away somewhere with somebody, the one person that's really the closest to you, and just escaping, getting away from it all and just, you know, weathering the storm, basically.
Yeah.
And the imagery through it, you know, is a lot of the imagery is basically about, you know, surviving a nuclear war, basically, right, and escaping to an island and just hunkering down and getting through it. But it's a metaphor for personal relationships.
Okay.
The nuclear storm thing came about because Cahir had moved to the very north coast of Northern Ireland, and he'd seen a news report where the Russians were apparently planning to drop the bomb on his new village, basically, because the jet stream and all the rest of it would then waft all of the waste across the whole of the rest of the UK. But he was going to be ground zero, and that was, I think, one of the other. That's what sparked the...
That's right. Yeah, so he'd literally been there he'd been there a week, I think, and then on Russian TV they had all of these diagrams, all of these images, and you saw the bomb tracking across the sky, and it was literally dropping on his village. It was quite something. He's like, he's literally in the most northern point of Ireland. He lives nowhere close to any military installations or anything of any strategic value. But for some reason, the Russians had one of their missiles pointed directly at where he lives.
Wow. So something that bleak has led to something that's fairly, yeah, I mean, the song's pretty powerful, but it came from something that dark. Wow. That's pretty depressing as well to find that out about your new location, I would think.
Yeah, I'm not sure he was best pleased at the time. But the good thing about Cahir is he's got a great sense of humour, so he always sees the funny side of things.
The gallows humour has to kick in with something like that, I would assume.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to take you back. I want to ask you how the Sleeping Souls came to be. I mean, you've been around, obviously, as quite some time. But, Taran, you especially, but Ben, you've got a hand in this as well from the written documentation on this. You were both involved in the hand of one of the greatest crimes known to music collectors of the world. And I just need to ask you how you defend this. For the radio, on a radio, that doesn't help that I'm holding something up. Dust Bowl, one of the first bands that you were both in, Tarrant, you were a founder, and Ben, you joined latterly, I believe, released your debut album in a silver plastic sphere that was impossible to store anywhere. I've never known what to do with that for all the years I've had it. Yeah, how do you defend that?
You have my abject apologies. I'm not sure who ever thought that was a good idea.
It sits on its own. I don't know what to do with it, but so it's always there. It's quite easy to see. So going back, sort of Dust Bowl, Dive. I mean, how did the Sleeping Souls come to be?
So Dust Bowl was a school band, basically. It came out of school, and it had run its course by about 2000, and it then evolved into Dive when members changed out, with a new drummer, Nigel, who was formerly of Unbelievable Truth. And so Dive we then did a few albums with, and we toured it. And I think we met Frank probably around about 2005 on tour with a band called Reuben. Okay, so yep. Frank's old band, Million Dead, had either just broken up or on the verge of breaking up. Frank was out doing merchandise for Reuben because they were all mates, and he just wanted to get away and do something different for a while. So we met him on that tour. We were playing, supporting Reuben, and got to know Frank. We got on like a house on fire. He mentioned that he was probably going to be doing a solo project. And at the time we had our own studio, which was it was all ex-BBC gear, 2-inch tape machines, huge old format console. And we basically just said to Frank, look, we've got a studio. If you're at a loose end, you know, come over, put some of your solo stuff down.
Okay.
And let's see what comes out of it. So he did. That was actually all. I used to live with my stepdad and my mum in a big old kind of rambling house. And that's where the studio was. He came over and basically spent the summer there, more or less. And we recorded Campfire Punk Rock. That was the first thing we did in the basement there. And that was the start of it, really. And it just kind of grew organically from there. There was no real one moment where we were like, this is going to be a big thing. It just kind of happened. You know, we took it a tour by a tour, a record by a record. At some point it kind of became a full-time job.
Yeah. We'll touch on the touring and how much touring you do, but you sort of, I think Ben, you mentioned that that this has been something you wanted to do for a while. And I read somewhere that and the album's called Just Before the World Starts Burning. It comes out tomorrow. But I read it's taken 3 years to come to fruition, 3 years to record. I mean, sort of, is that due to the day job, so to speak, or why has it taken so long?
Well, I think it's the day job, the horrible COVID C word didn't help either, as we didn't then see each other for about 18 months. But I think, I mean, the roots were before then, probably another 3 years of kicking a few ideas around and trying to get stuff together. But I think actually probably it was during the COVID times that we really said, let's do this now, because we can, and because the technology is there for us to record bits and bobs at home and then send them around to each other and actually start pushing it together. And I think we got the first couple of songs done and thought, actually, I think there's something here that's that we think is good, and hopefully other people might, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I said I think the reaction to the singles so far has been good. I've not seen early reviews of the album, but I've liked everything I've heard, and I'm looking forward to getting my hands on it. We're now going to listen to another one of the tracks, one of the earlier singles from the album, which is Rivals. Four singles that have been taken from the album so far are pretty different in style. And what was the writing process from it? I mean, you just touched on some of it. I mean, was it very collaborative? Were you all bringing different things to the table?
Yeah, I think that's fair, actually. I think that's one of the reasons it is so diverse a record, is that it's their ideas from everybody have come in. So some of them from Ben, some ideas from me. Probably the major... the two people who've had the most influence over it would be Cahir and Matt, but I think you can see influences from everybody in the band in there. One of the things for us was wanting to do something that was self-consciously not in exactly the same vein as Frank, because it would have been very easy for us to say, let's do Frank Turner Light.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And so we wanted to do something different that was not treading the same territory, and so there wasn't any kind of confusion there, so to speak. And I think we've succeeded in doing that.
Yeah, no, I'd certainly agree. You wouldn't be able to tell straight away that the Sleeping Souls are and Frank Turner. It's definitely got its own sound to it. I think that's definitely it's worked then. Yeah. So, and 15 years of Frank as a front man. I mean, how did Cahir step into that role? I mean, and how did he become part of the band?
You want to take this one, Ben?
I can do. We've known him as basically as long, if not longer, than we've known Frank, actually, from his work in Jet Plane Landing, where he was guitarist, and then he was in Fighting With Wire, who I think Dive Dive, possibly Dust Bowl, played some shows with. So I think there's been, it's been, you know, we've everybody's known each other in the camp for a long time. And Cahir comes out on tour and does some of the roadieing slash tech guitar teching stuff with us out on tour. And he's also, he's stepped into a number of our roles and filled in when we've needed it in the past. Frank, when he slipped one disc and herniated another, Cahir learnt all the acoustic parts in a week, and his first show was Reading Festival main stage.
Blimey. Okay.
And he's been around a while, but I've never, you don't normally see it, but that was one of the few times I've seen Cahir nervous before. Yeah. But, you know, when me and Tarrant had our children, he's also learned our parts and stepped in and done all that. So he's very much part of the family, the touring family.
He is basically a proxy sleeping soul. It's not a big stretch to call him a sleeping soul, really, which is why it made sense.
Yeah, okay, excellent. Mentioned the touring and some of the gigs again. I mean, you've played huge venues. I mean, main stage at Reading, headlined Wembley Arena, that little thing at the Olympics sort of opening ceremony. I've been lucky enough to see you live a few times. And you really all do seem to actually enjoy playing live. It seems to be something that you see some bands and that doesn't always come across, but it seems something that you're passionate and enjoy. I mean, but which sort of gigs do you prefer? Do you the huge ones, the more intimate ones, or does everything bring a different thing?
All of them, I think. I think it's the variety. You get bored doing any one type of show. To give you an example, at the beginning of festival season, everybody's really hyped to be going and doing festivals because it's, you know, it's nice to be out in the summer and doing nice big shows outside, big stages, all the rest of it. About halfway through the summer, everybody's kind of got, oh my God, please, no more festivals. Can we go back to doing our own tours? And it's the same with everything. You know, it's nice doing really small, intimate shows. It's nice doing big shows. It's the mix of them that makes life interesting.
Excellent. And I take it you do enjoy them as much as it seems. So you can't put that on, can you? I mean, that's...
Yeah, sorry, go on, Ben.
I think it's an odd choice of job, and it takes us away from family and friends for a lot of time. Mm. I think you have to enjoy it, otherwise you wouldn't carry on doing it as long as we've been doing it.
Yeah. That's a very good point. Yeah, there's been a lot of gigs. You were one of the first bands to actually take to the stage. I think it was the night that the COVID restrictions were lifted, mentioning the C word again, at the Clapham Grand. I was there that night, and I must admit, I got pretty emotional. And yeah, that was dust in my eye, definitely. But I mean, how did that feel? Sort of stepping back out on stage with that audience and doing it after so long, and not including the socially distanced and the online gigs and everything.
I think it was pretty. It was an amazing feeling, definitely. And like you, I think all of us on stage were pretty emotional about it as well. It definitely felt we were unsure. We were unsure of what the future held at that point, and we definitely didn't have confidence that this thing that we were doing was going to go on. So it was a little bit. It was like a tentative first step outside into the sunlight. Yeah, I mean, I certainly wouldn't want to go back to COVID. That was not a fun 2 years.
No, I mean, I can't imagine. But for the likes, yeah, as you say, it's your chosen career, and to have that taken away from you must have been heartbreaking. And the stuff that you and Frank did to support the small venues and all of that kind of thing was actually really inspirational for the people that were sitting on the sidelines watching. So
mainly,
thank you for that.
Mainly Frank, I'd have to say. Honestly, the man is an inspiration when it comes in terms of the work that he does for charities, and he's very, very focused and driven on giving back and doing whatever he can to help people. So that's, you know, that's down to him. I don't think we can particularly take credit for that ourselves.
Okay. You're currently touring New Zealand and Australia, but then you're back in the UK and doing Sleeping Souls gigs. You're playing, so there's a few gigs, including one in London at the Garage in Islington in January. How's it going to feel to actually get there and play these songs that were your ideas and your songs and your stuff?
We don't know.
Oh, right.
I mean, these are literally the first shows, so we don't actually know. I mean, I think it's going to be exciting.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a little bit like walking down to the sea the first day on holiday and dipping your toe into the ocean, not knowing whether it's going to be warm or it's going to be cold, or, you know, what the experience
shark infest.
Yeah, you're going to get stung by a jellyfish. Who knows? Yeah,
it's okay. But looking forward to them, I'm sure.
Absolutely. Really looking forward to playing this stuff live. Particularly some of the, for me anyway, particularly some of the faster, heavier stuff. I think it's going to be fun.
Yeah, and Garage, a great little venue. It should be absolutely, a great night, I would think. Looking forward to that. So is this a one-off, or is there more music within the band and more plans for...
I think we've always seen this as a kind of long-term thing. It's definitely, our main job, our main function is to be Frank's band. And as and when we have time to do more Sleeping Soul stuff, we'll do more Sleeping Soul stuff, probably put out another record. And on that record, we'll probably tour it. It's not a focus where we're going to tour it hard and, go and try and take it all around the world and spend, 18 months doing that. That's
not yet. Not yet.
Not yet. Maybe in 5 years' time when Frank settled down and just decided to put on his slippers and we want to do more music. We want to play more shows, but we're not in a mad rush. We'll just take our time and pace it.
So I mean, I saw an ex Sleeping Soul. I went to see the Unbelievable Truth at Bush Hall last month, I think it was, and they supported themselves with the acoustic and then the full band and everything. Any temptation for Sleeping Souls to support Frank Turner and the Sleeping Souls? I mean, would that work, or would you just be too exhausted to do?
It sounds like hard work to me.
It sounds too tiring.
Yeah. I suppose the benefit for the Unbelievable Truth was it was acoustic and a lot more gentle than some of the stuff that you're certainly doing live. So the album is released tomorrow on all good streaming services, and there's physical nice blue and green vinyl and CD versions from Extramile Recordings and everything. So if for you listener, if you want that, you can go and buy it or go and stream it as of tomorrow. Thank you both for your time today. Enjoy the rest of your time down under, and we look forward to seeing you when you're back in the UK and playing those live dates.
Thanks very much, Gareth.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Gareth.
And from the album, Just Before the World Starts Burning, as I said, released tomorrow, we're going to finish off with another single. This is Caught Up in the Scrape.
Yeah.